You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast.
Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast. This is Jason, and with me in conversation today is Jamie. And today we are going to be talking about the question, why does God care about our sexuality or who we sleep with? And we're going to be looking at God's design for human sexuality. And Jamie, as I think about this subject, I can't help but think about how much chaos and confusion we have right now. Really, it's not just in the U.S., but we really do see it in, especially in the U.S. and Europe and a lot of these places where we have all these modern technological advances. We have so many conveniences ready at hand. And yet we also have this incredible amount of confusion. And I would argue that there is a connection, at least not necessarily with advances in technology, but there's a connection with confusion around our view of sexuality and the secularism that pervades our culture. So here's just a couple of things that may or may not surprise you. Probably at this point doesn't really surprise you, but I think it's just worth throwing out on the table just to kind of give a pulse of where our culture is at right now. In 2017, the Gallup organization found that 69% of Americans believe it is morally acceptable to have sex outside of marriage. In fact, it said in the report, waiting until marriage for fulfilling sex life is considered not just quaint and outdated, but quite possibly foolish. And I think that just when you watch a lot of the, you know, sitcoms or be it reality TV shows, things like that, the music that is being produced today, we really get this skewed and confused picture of what sex is all about. And really, I guess the two obvious errors in my mind, I'm curious what you see, Jamie, but what I see is that it's part of it is we are coming at sex with a view that we can define our own private morality. And this is what happens when you have a secular society. You no longer have a creator God who has designed sex and who has given it a purpose and filled it with meaning. And instead, it becomes really reduced to meaningless recreation. And it's all about chemicals and bodily functions, and there's no real morality attached to it anymore, at least when you come at it from the secular angle. And I think that a lot of people in the West and in America have bought into that whole worldview, which basically says we don't need a God to tell us the purpose or the value of sex. And so we're going to make up our own purpose and value. And the other thing would be that, and kind of in tandem with that, is we have sort of bought into this idea that because of evolution and because of Darwin's theory and how we came about as a human race, that really it's a good and natural thing to want to sleep with whoever you want. And that marriage is more the late addition, late kind of quaint thing that our society came up with. Sort of it's a societal convention, but it's something we can do away with and doesn't really need to be connected with sex. But I'm curious, Jamie, when you look at our culture, you look at how the West has grown to think about sex in general, what are some things that come to mind for you?
I think like you were saying, you know, the starting point of this worldview actually goes back to Enlightenment movement, which, you know, sort of began or developed in the French Revolution time period, you know, in the 1700s. And late 1700s, early 1800s. And that movement really gave way to the idea that we now call, you know, postmodernism or post-postmodernism, this idea that there is no absolutes, there is no moral law, I guess you'd say, because certainly they don't recognize, you know, postmodernism doesn't recognize the existence of God. You know, only that which can be known is what can be proven through science. And even then, postmodernism doesn't even hold to absolutes in that sense as well. And so really, I'd say over the course of at least, you know, the last 100 years here in the United States, the prevailing ideas that have existed are, you know, have been pretty well evidenced, you know, in people like Hugh Hefner, who, of course, is, you know, the founder of Playboy, which was sort of the pioneer of porn, I guess you'd say, at least in the modern sense. And he and his influences, you know, are really born out of that mindset that, you know, all of these things are just purely biological functions. In a sense, we're just animals and we need our desires to be met however we desire them. In fact, one of Hugh Hefner's mentors was a psychologist. I can't remember the guy's name off the top of my head, but he was actually known for being a pedophile as well. And basically the argument was the same, that this sexual revolution extends itself even to the things that we would as a society still to some degree consider perverse and inappropriate. I would add evil to that. But all of that is just the animalistic nature of man. And the more we desire, the more we should just do and fulfill. And the result, yeah, like you're saying, has been pretty devastating on our culture. And you see it, I think, really in every aspect of our society, even the church itself. The majority of people in the church do not even view sexuality in light of a biblical lens. It's really, and I've even had people tell me this, that all that the Bible says about sexuality is merely just an opinion. It's one view. It's not the only view. Certainly those same people are definitely not living in line with a biblical ethic while, you know, claiming to be a Christian.
Yeah, no, this is one of the reasons why, excuse me, one of the reasons why I thought it would be so important to talk about this also is because the fact is our culture is evangelizing a certain view of sex. In other words, they are spreading a message about sex that comes from a purely secular perspective, a godless perspective. And really, if we as the church, if we don't speak out to these issues, then young people in particular are going to be buying into the worldview that they see on TV, that they read about, or that they that's just pervading our culture. And that's why we need to speak about this issue, because it's something where I think there's this naive idea that if conservative Christians just kind of almost like pretend that this whole, if they pretend that there, you know, there's no such thing as a crisis in how we view this, then yeah, there's going to be problems. And so that's why we need to be able to speak to this issue with clarity and not be trying to pretend that it can be papered over.
Well, let's break that down, you know, a little bit further. If you look at all of the polling that's been done on this question, looking, you know, specifically at the church, what we find is among single Christians, 6 out of 10 actively engage in sexual relationships with people they're not married to. When you look at, you know, pornography, we understand that 69% of all Christian men regularly engage in it in some form or another. We recognize 35% of women do the same thing as well, are engaged in pornography. And now we're even seeing the realities of transgenderism and or bisexuality. You know, these sort of things are definitely, you know, a thing, especially, you know, you look at youth groups and stuff like that. I've seen many, many cases of, you know, these kind of things just in the churches I've directly worked with. So we're not talking about, you know, this is a theoretical issue out there. And where this comes to a head, I guess, is if we want the world to see the beauty of the gospel, because we would argue, and we will argue, that we believe sexuality is created by God for a beautiful design, and that design is in line with our best and God's glory. And so, you know, for that case to be made, then the church has to represent that to the world. And that's not to say, you know, perfectly, like we're never going to have struggles with these areas. In fact, I think we will always have struggles with these areas. But if we want people to see the beauty of God's design, then the church has to represent it.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the other side effects of not talking about it as a church and as those who hold the biblical authority is that you end up basically sending the message to young people that because mum's the word on sex, then essentially sex equals sin, which is not true. There are distortions of sex that, of course, are sinful and they're against God's design. But sex, as God intended, is a beautiful thing. It's a priceless thing that I think conveys so much more than probably most Christians recognize. And so that's one of the things we got to be able to convey also to young people is that God designed it. He's responsible for it. It's not as though God, you know, created the, you know, the upper body, the legs, the feet, and then, you know, Satan's responsible for, you know, for our, you know, our sexual desires and things like that. That's not how it works. God created it. Now, what we do with that design matters, and how we rightly represent it in marriage, the marriage covenant, that matters. But people need to know that this is something that originally was something God created good, and it began in the Garden of Eden.
Yeah, and even, you know, look at, like, I'm thinking of Proverbs 5, for example, which really encourages the delight in marriage. You know, it says in Proverbs 5, verse 15 and on, it says, drink water from your own cistern. Why? Or water flowing from your own well. Should your springs flow in the streets, streams of water in the public square? They should be for you alone and not for you to share with strangers. Let your fountain be blessed. Take pleasure in the wife of your youth, a loving doe, a graceful fawn. Let her breasts always satisfy you. Be lost in her love forever. I mean, that's not just God saying, okay, I created it, you need to procreate, but it's, you know, it's sort of this bad or ugly or gross kind of just, okay, do what you got to do in the context of marriage. And that's that. It's like, no, actually, there's a whole book of the Bible that's devoted to the poetry of the love of marriage. And part of that is sexuality. I mean, obviously, intimacy is more than just sex. So God created it, and God also delights in it. In fact, we would go as far as to say that sex in God's design is actually worship.
For sure. And I mean, and a big part of that is because in marriage, you have a covenantal commitment. And this is why I would say one of the biggest reasons why sex outside of marriage is such a horrible distortion of God's design. It's because sex was always intended to be an expression or overflow of that covenantal commitment between a man and a woman, which, as we're going to see, we're going to talk about this in a bit, but that represents the gospel. That's a picture, a living, physical, vivid picture of what the gospel is about when we come to Christ. There's a union with God between God and his people. And as strange as that may sound, we can explain that in just a bit. But here's what ends up happening. People with a secular worldview will often, and I've heard this on college campuses, people have tried to persuade me of this view that when they are having sex outside of marriage or having, you know, knowingly sleeping with their girlfriend, what they will say is it's actually wise because now they are seeing if they are compatible. And that's better because if they would say marriage is important to us, we want to make sure we found the right one. So we're seeking out this person, experimenting essentially, and we're seeing if we are compatible. And here's why that's a big problem. Because when you view sex outside the context of marriage, you're not just devaluing sex, you are actually devaluing people. And you take on this consumer mentality where you think of people as sort of this this lineup of products that you're going to choose from. And if something doesn't fit what you desire, what you like, then you can essentially, and I'm using this word in the general sense, you're throwing them away like we would with a product that we buy from the store. We no longer need it, so we're throwing it away. And that devalues people. That's why it matters, because whether you like it or not, sex is a very powerful emotional, psychological experience between two people. You cannot pretend that it's just this recreational activity that has no consequences when you decide you're going to no longer be with that person.
Well, you know what's really interesting is science has actually further helped us understand what it is that God has been telling us. And what you're saying is not just true in a theoretical sense. It's actually true in a real sense as well. So the brain is designed for the pleasure sensor of your brain is the part of your brain that actually bonds with the source of sexual gratification, right? And it's designed to do that. So in the context of marriage, when you're married and you have sex with your spouse, that actually bonds the two of you together in a real, not just a chemical way, but also a brain structure sense as well. And so so that becomes a really good thing. It's like in the context of marriage, every time you're sexually engaging with your spouse, you're actually building greater and stronger bonds with that person, which is really cool. But when you engage sexually with people that you're not married to, and you go from person to person, what ends up happening in your brain is you actually lose the human element of that. You lose the ability to bond with an actual person. And they literally, you begin to view people as objects, like Jason was saying. And so this isn't just like, we're not just being moralists here saying, you know, this is the effect on people. It's like, no, this is actually true. Just like, you know, somebody who's engaging in pornography, they actually get to a point where they are unable to sexually engage with a real woman because they've bonded with these images or these videos. And, you know, real women aren't anything like that. And so they're actually unable to even be aroused by actual people, be able to engage in healthy relationship in the context of marriage. And so so what Jason is saying is we're not just talking moral realities here. God tells us not to do this because he made us. He created our brain. He created our body. He knows how it's all supposed to work. And if we misuse it, and when we misuse it, it takes what is a beautiful gift from God and turns it into a weapon of our own destruction.
Yeah, and that's a great point, Jamie, and I love this. As a Christian, I love it when science confirms what God has been telling us all along. And really, this is exactly right, that the clinical and psychological studies for years, I mean, long time, it's not like this is a recent finding, for years have known that when two people commit to one another, there is this, just like Jamie was saying, there's the chemical bonding that actually takes place. The, you know, there's oxytocin, that's a bonding hormone. There's dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter that makes us feel good, essentially. And then endorphins, which, you know, that's like a natural stress reducer. All of those things happen when a couple is committed to one another, and there's that bond. On the flip side of the coin, and this is something else, that when you don't have that covenantal commitment and you treat sex more like this, you know, you have this consumerism mentality towards sex, you get the opposite effect. And we've seen the fallout of this, that men and women have experienced more and more emotional and psychological issues as a result of having multiple sexual partners. And so this is not just, as Jamie said, it's not just theoretical, it's not just words on the pages of scripture. It is something that scientific studies, secular scientific studies, not just focus on the family, this is scientific studies that bear this out and confirm, yeah, when you go against God's design, there are consequences. But I think it's also important, Jamie, as we talk about this, to make some points about how we talk about it and the fact that we want to express both grace and truth when we talk about sex, because this, honestly, this is one of those issues. It's so sensitive for so many people. A lot of people have felt like they can't express their sexual struggles in the context of the church and with other Christians. They feel like it's something they need to hide, they need to conceal, because they look around them and nobody else is talking about them. And so it's like, okay, there's this picture of what a Christian should look like, shouldn't have any sexual struggles, so I can't talk about it. Well, here's the problem. The Bible wants us to confess to one another. It talks about confession over and over in Scripture. And until we get to that point where we're able to talk about our struggles, we really won't be dealing with them. And we'll be hurting ourselves in the long run, because we'll be staying in the muck and mire of our secret sins, and we won't be able to find that grace that Jesus is offering us. He's pleading with us to come to him with our struggles and to confess it to one another, so that, if we confess it just to God, that's so important. But there's something about confessing it to other believers that really pulls it out. And in a sense, it just makes it more real when you've talked about it and you recognize, okay, I have these accountability partners. I have these people over here that are praying for me. They love and accept me despite of my struggles. And it's not an issue of I gotta pretend, I gotta put a face up like I have no issues in this area. Instead, you can talk about it. And sadly, one of the biggest areas I've seen this in is when it comes to same-sex attraction. This is not obviously the only area, but I would say it's tragic how in the past so often those in the church who struggled with same-sex attraction felt like they had zero space to talk about it. And so the long term, the end run of all this was that they decided they didn't belong, because whenever homosexuality was discussed, it was almost like it's so gross that whoever would even consider being in that area, in that realm, would have to be the worst person imaginable. And that's a tragic thing, because while homosexuality is a distortion of God's design, it's not as though God called it out as the worst sin at all. There are a multiplicity of sexual struggles that people have, and we need to be able to talk about those in the church. People need to be able to find space for confession and find help and find grace. And really, what better place than the Church of Jesus Christ?
Yeah, I think part of the problem, begins with the teaching of the church. For example, you know, a lot of churches have really just avoided the topic of sexuality. Instead of giving a beautiful, God glorifying picture of it, right? I mean, it's kind of like, at least I remember growing up in the church, my understanding of sex was that it's bad, it's dirty, it's gross, it's, you know, and we just somehow babies came about and we just really didn't ever talk about it, you know, and that just, it was just that thing out there.
And it was historic, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you grow up in an environment like that and you're like, I mean, you feel, I think if everybody is honest, at least I know this is true of men. Obviously, I don't know that we can speak for women here because we're not, but at least from a male perspective, I think the sexual desire is probably the strongest force of any other desires in the human body. At least that's what seems to be true, in my own experience. And I'm, you know, everybody else, that I've talked to or interacted with, it's a huge thing. And so when the church is not talking about it, it's like you have this huge thing and you don't know what to do really with it. You don't know how to glorify God in it. And you really haven't been given a beautiful picture for, you know, what marriage is supposed to be, how it's supposed to look. And it's like, there's nothing more beautiful to me than, you know, really seeing God's design. You know, I think a great example of that is in Ephesians chapter 5, you know, verse like 25, where, you know, the Apostle Paul says, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her with the washing of water by the word. He did this to present the church to himself in splendor without spot or wrinkle or anything like that, but holy and blameless. In the same way, husbands are to love their wives as their own body. He who loved his wife, he who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hates his own flesh, but provides and cares for it, just as Christ does for the church, since we are members of his body. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two become one flesh. This mystery is profound, and this is the coolest part about all this, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. To sum it up, each one of you is to love his wife as himself, and a wife should respect her husband." I mean, what a beautiful picture of it's, you know, this whole idea of marriage and sexuality and intimacy and, that covenantal commitment that Jason was talking about earlier, all of that goes into this beautiful picture of Christ's love for the church. And when you see that, like, now all of a sudden it's not gross and dirty and disgusting and perverted and weird, and it's this holy thing in a sense. And I think we can call it a holy thing because the Bible calls it a holy thing. And so, right. And so we get this beautiful picture. And so part of it is that, okay, first of all, we present the good about it. And then on the other side, the bonus of that good is to say that the encouragement to walk out our sexuality in a God-honoring way is not to deprive desire, but to actually fulfill it. It's to actually bring about the fullness of all that God is. And I can say, you know, from a pastoral perspective, you know, having talked with many, many people who have made sexual choices that were outside the design of God. And in every single case, when you ask the question, you know, was that worth it? I mean, are you glad that you stepped outside the design of God and the result is, you know, all of this destruction and disaster and just hurt. I've never once had somebody tell me, yeah, no, it was totally worth it. In fact, everybody has just massive regret and pain and all that. But on the reverse side, when you talk to a couple that has walked out their sexuality in line with the design of God, here's the crazy part. Not only are they super happy, super satisfied, and it's awesome, but they also are experiencing a lot more sex and sexual interaction. Now, I can already hear the objection. What are you talking about? All these married couples are always complaining about not having good sexual interaction and all these sort of things. And my response to that is to say, in each of those cases, what you find is that couple is not really walking out the design of God. Because remember, it's more than just sex. Sex is the culmination of intimacy. There's that emotional, spiritual bond that has to happen. And if a husband is not loving his wife, if he's not caring about his wife, if they're not emotionally connecting, if they're not spiritually connecting, if all of that is not happening, then you're really not walking out the design of God. And so you're not going to see the fruits of that. So Jason, I want you to maybe respond to all of that. And then also, I think we got to deal with the question that comes up all the time. I think primarily more with single people. How far is too far? In terms of they want to use their sexuality in a way God gave it to them, and they want to be able to use it in some form, but they're not married. And so maybe respond to, you know, is there a place for that? I mean, what does delighting in your sexuality as a single person mean? Because it's just a really common question on this topic.
That's a great question. So the first thing I was going to say with regard to what you said about married couples, and yes, 100% agree. This is something we don't want to overlook, because, you know, if a listener is married, and that there could be this sort of too quick to feel self-satisfied kind of smugness, thinking, oh, well, then I've done everything right. Well, marriage takes a lot of work. And the reality is that just because you're married does not mean that you are expressing yourself sexually in a God-honoring way. And what I mean by that is there's obviously a culmination factor, like Jamie said. Sex should be the fruit of this intimate bond between a man and a woman in the context of marriage. And if a husband is neglecting his wife in every other area and then expects to be, just pleased in the marriage bed rather than serving her and not seeking to know her intimately in all the other ways, countless other ways that you can get to know another person, then yeah, that's a huge problem. And we shouldn't overlook that, because I think that there's a tendency, probably even in the church, for us to baptize almost every idea of marital sex as if it's always going well, when there's probably oftentimes there's this disconnect going on between the husband and wife, and that needs to be addressed first and foremost, and not assuming that everything's a-okay just because you're having sex or just because you're married. So the other thing with singleness, and you know, this is so important, because I think that if we're honest, probably a lot of single people are going to be listening and thinking, well, this is great in, you know, for all those people who have been married or are married. But what about me, and how do I fit into this picture? Because if this is expression of the gospel, if this is a picture of Christ's union with the church and God's love for the world and that covenantal love God has for us, where do I fit in? And I think a couple things. Paul in 1 Corinthians doesn't neglect talking about single people. That's encouraging just to know that it's addressed, first of all, that the Bible doesn't pretend that single people don't exist. After just talking about all the dangers of sexual immorality in 1 Corinthians 6 and really offering a lot of warnings to people who would play with fire, so to speak, he then encourages married couples to not deprive each other. But then he says, you know, for the unmarried, here's some things to think about. He says in verse 8, now to the unmarried and the widows I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I do. So Paul was a single dude. Clearly, we don't look at Paul and think, man, that guy was just not living a faithful life. He clearly was. He was a single dude. But then he says in verse 9, but if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Now, people, it's interesting to read commentaries on this verse, and, you know, what does Paul mean by that? Can't control themselves. Like, married people are just those people without self-control. I would say what's going on here is Paul is saying, if you have this very strong desire to get married, and you're single, then it's probably you're probably not necessarily called to singleness, at least not long term, because he says they should marry. If they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. In other words, if you find yourself in that situation where you're like, I struggle with this, I really long to be married, then by all means, why not seek out a mate, seek out a covenantal partner, a spouse? Why not? That's in the Lord, obviously. That's what Paul talks about later in 1 Corinthians 7. So that's the first thing, is be open to the idea that God has someone for you. And I that sounds so cliche, but I really mean that, in the sense that don't count yourself out as far as I have no chance of ever being married. I know lots of people who have been married late in life, thinking that they were going to be single their whole lives and struggling with that for a long time. They end up getting married in their late 30s, 40s, 50s, even beyond that. So I would just say, for the time being, you may be single, but maybe God hasn't called you to lifelong singleness, if this is where you're at. Now, the other side of the coin is, if you're at peace with that, because Paul actually says there's great benefit to being single. And he talks about this, especially later in the chapter. He says, really, it's good to, if you can be single, essentially, he says, if you can be single, then you're free from all these concerns that married people have to be concerned with, because they have to be faithful to their wife. They have to be showing concern for their spouse. A single guy he's in a much better position to hop on a flight immediately and go to a foreign nation. He's in a much better position to stay up late, helping others, serving in the community, all these different areas. Paul says, look, don't see your singleness as a curse. See it as a gift that actually gives you more opportunities in certain areas than the married guy or the married woman. And I guess the other side of the coin, again, is that Paul says it's not wrong to get married. So if you're in that place where you've been single for a while, again, he says it's not a sin. And just know that maybe for a time you were called to singleness, but maybe it's not for always. Maybe it was just for that stage in your life. But it's good for us to see that purpose that God has for single people, for however long, if it's lifelong or if it's temporary. It's good to see that God has a goal and purpose behind that, and it's not as though you're counted out of the equation just because God has this beautiful, beautiful design for sex in marriage.
I would actually add just one more, I think, additional piece to that, to say, in singleness, do you have an opportunity to glorify God in your sexuality? And the answer is yes. So what Jason is saying is, you know, if you can accept it, great. God has a great ministry opportunity for you in that. Or if you can get married, that's great. You know, God has great opportunity for you in that. I think Paul also speaks to the reality of right now. So whether I'm hoping to be married, or whether I, you know, am pretty comfortable or confident in the fact that, you know, for the good of the gospel, I'm not going to be, there's still a glorifying God in your sexuality that gets to happen. And I would actually point to 1 Corinthians chapter 6. So one chapter before, at the very end, verse 18 through 20, he says, run from sexual immorality. Every sin a person commits is outside the body. On the contrary, the person who is sexually immoral sins against his own body. Do you not know that your body is the sanctuary of the Holy Spirit, who is in you, whom you have from God? You are not your own, for you were bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body. And this is not just to married people. This is to all of us, single, married. It's glorify God in your body. And yes, how you glorify God in your body is different, you know, whether you're married or single, but the call, the charge to glorify God in your body is the same. And so as a single person, I would say God calls to glorify God in the body by sexual purity in one sense, to be a picture of devotion, you know, solely committed to Christ as a single person. That isn't to say you can't still hope for marriage, but you're showing that commitment to Christ. And that in and of itself is a beautiful thing. But I also think you can take it as far as to say that the encouragement of Christ is to use those sexual desires, to use that that driving energy and passion for the work of Christ, for the production of beautiful, for bringing, you know, spiritual life in a sense. That energy, that sexual energy that God gives you can actually be used and is easily used for a lot of different, purposes that are non-sexual. And it gives you more energy, more drive to be able to refocus in a sense and put towards the gospel. And that to me is just such a cool, beautiful picture of, you know, if you're married, then you're glorifying God by sexually engaging your wife exclusively in the design of God, you know, which is built on that loving intimacy of emotional, spiritual, relational connection. And that becomes a beautiful picture of Christ's love for the church. And if you're single, that devotion to Christ also becomes that beautiful picture as well. And so whether married or single, there's a way to glorify God in all of this. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time. We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to hear past episodes, please subscribe on your favorite podcasting site or go to our website, faithunpacked.com. And if you have any questions, feel free to get in touch with us. You can send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com or you can hit us up on social media. And join us next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.